Here.
And Eric's there too.
Eric's here. All right, then we'll get started. Welcome. Just a reminder that this meeting is being recorded and will be posted on the Deeb's website when we're complete. And let's go through quickly with introductions. Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Mike Odrin, Olson Engineering.
Sherry Jones.
Jamie Husley, Jordan Ramis.
Eric Galima, SJ Engineering.
Nick Fragg, Clark Public Utilities.
Don Russo, retired from Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt.
Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Seth Halling with AKS Engineering.
Mike Salas with Clark County.
Greg Schaefer, Clark County, interim Community Development Director.
Susan Wilson, Clark County Public Works.
The line too. Thank you. Community Plan. Sorry.
Diana Nett, Development Engineering.
Susan Ellinger, Community Planning.
Ravi Mahajan, the Plan Review Manager.
Ren Davis.
Go ahead, Max. Oh. Brent Davis, Land Use Review Manager and Wetland and Habitat Review Manager.
Max Booth, Inspection Services Manager and Building Safety.
Jenna Kay, Community Planning.
Rob Klug, Public Works.
Rod Swanson, Public Works.
Justin Wood, BIA of Clark County.
Phil Waste, Ginn Group.
John McSherry, Clark County.
Chris Carl, Clark County.
Justin Maynard, Clark County.
All right, well, everybody, welcome. Big group today. Let's see here. Has anybody had the opportunity to review the minutes so we can adopt them from last month?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've reviewed them and I move for approval.
Okay.
I chaired last month.
Hooray, second. Thank you very much, Jamie. All right. All in favor of approving our minutes?
All right.
Greg, should we just jump right into the transformer issue and we'll follow up with your upcoming events?
Yes, that sounds great.
Okay. So, sounds like there is a upcoming transformer issue that's going to affect an awful lot of projects. From what I understand, there's around 400 transformers that are now around 4 to 5 months late. Does that summarize the issue?
I would add that the date of arrival of these transformers is an estimate. And it could be longer. And it's not just transformers either, it's other materials. So speaking just on the utility side, I know we've looked at trying to get refurbished transformers and other, streetlights could be a concern long-term. And then, on the water side, we're starting to see a delay on just pipe and valves and fittings and stuff like that. So things seem to be, transformers seem to be the longest thing out, but there's other materials that are coming on that list that are starting to lag on availability.
Okay. So Is there any possibility of getting any kind of refurbished transformers then? Is that what you guys are looking at?
Well, that was the plan B is, you know, if we can't find something that's new, what can we find that's used? And there's still like a long, I mean, this isn't just a Clark County, this is nationwide. We've had some conversation with surrounding PUDs and just to see what they're doing, and they're all doing the same thing. They're trying to find refurbished or new, and they just can't get, the supply is just not there.
Okay. All right, and I just wanted to bring it in front of Dee because the way I understand it is, like with the residential subdivision, we can't record the plat. We wouldn't be recording the plat until the transformers are in, which means that we have quite a lengthy delay, and we already have delays. By the time the plat's recorded, you know, by the time I break ground, it looks like it's about 2.5 months. So I was bringing it forward to see if there's a way that we could keep the plat moving forward, plats moving forward, and then talk about commercial projects, because those are going to be a big impact too.
I was discussing this with Don before everybody came on board, and the question is whether or not the transformers could fall under a public improvement and therefore be eligible for bonding. And would see what staff maybe had to say about that.
Mike, yeah, I was actually with the BIA this morning and having somewhat similar conversations. Probably, I think the best way to frame this right now is 2 days ago, we had zero awareness. I'm not trying to say that in any kind of a slight. I don't know who of us was really aware. But Dan, thank you for bringing it to our attention. I think it was just yesterday morning the email came in. I would put the status right now into it has absolutely got our attention, and there is significant awareness across the county at this point. I know that our county manager is aware. She's aware that we were having conversations today, both with the BIA and DEEB. This is very good. She wanted us to start to work on this, obviously. As soon as I got it from Dan, I put it across our departments or divisions that I thought, you know, needed awareness on it, our permit center, building, development engineering, land use. And so that's the point that we're at right now. I'm glad that we're having this discussion. I don't think it'll take the county very long to come to, you know, to start to lay some groundwork on a pathway forward on this. I don't know that I can get there today in this meeting, but a few things that do come to mind is absolutely looking at what are the bonding options with this thing. I think that very much comes to mind. We need to take a look at that as one area. A second area is, and I raised it with the BIA, they thought they could get over this hurdle, but just the logistics of not having power on that site and just, you know, functionally being able to build from that point. That's not so much an internal thing for county staff, but it'd be good to know what kind of situation the builders and contractors are in a situation like that. And then ultimately, I would have to say that I don't know how we get to any position of occupancy, you know, absent that delivery of electrical power. You know, I think that's kind of the ultimate stopgap, but, you know, and I think that we'll probably have agreement at that point, but we want to do what we can to, you know, facilitate forward movement on these projects and have it to be a manageable challenge that we've got and that we can work on. So I'm talking a little bit more in principle in this point. I think the next move would be if we've got some interested folks out of both the BIA and DEEB that would like to meet with staff on more of a kind of a subgroup and work quickly on this. I don't think it'll be lengthy, but I just think we need an additional meeting where we can really get our arms around this a little bit better. And what does it look like step by step as we plat projects and moving them forward? So Does that help at all? And I think Jamie had his hand raised there.
Yeah, and Greg, I agree with you. I think I really appreciate you guys being solution oriented on that. I think that's awesome. I have more of a practical question, and maybe Nick has the answer for this. Is this a situation like where the dam's going to break and like all these 400 transformers show up at once, and meanwhile we still have projects going through the approval, or is this going to be seen kind of as a problem that's going to have a long tail on it? Because I could see this being a real, we may need to get more creative.
I don't know the answer to that, honestly. I'm not sure. I know it's just been, there's a material supply. I mean, there's stuff that just isn't made here domestically that we're having, some of the manufacturers are having an issue with, and then it's labor and then trucking. You know, everything's held up. So it's across the board. It's really hard to predict.
Hey, Nick, another question.
This is John Gerard. I can.
Go ahead, John.
They're only one of their major suppliers, Cascade, that supplies. But in the same boat, shed some light. Prairie put the order in for their transformers. So, order now is delayed, probably, well, they're saying is roughly March or April. If that doesn't do anything, then, like, if someone will order something new today, they're quoting it. So to kind of address Jamie's question, we're going to be in.
John, you're cutting out. You're not coming through.
No. Let me see if I can move here. I'm in a building. Let me see if I can move.
Hey, John, you're good right there. That sounded pretty good.
Okay. Yeah. So I talked with Prairie Electric, and another major supplier to the subdivision is Cascade, and they've been conversing. Of course, they're sourcing all their products, refurbished, everything, every network they got. But their order for Prairie was for 500 last April. And that's the order they're waiting for now that's pushed off to next March, April. Holy. Anything new they're ordering now, they're being quoted 11 months. So we're just going to be in this a while. We just got to get creative.
Okay. John, thank you. A question while we've got Nick, and apologize a little bit in the weeds here. I'm just, this is such a new one. Nick, where the utilities sign off on the final plans, would you anticipate that the bonding would come through the utility, or is that still through the county? Any thoughts on that?
I would think it would come through the county. Utility doesn't take ownership of anything until it's there and past all the physical inspection. So we don't really have a whole lot into it until that point.
Okay. Dan, just a thought here, but I'd be happy to head up a subgroup. Anybody would like to join in, but I think on the county side, I need to get a Diana in there that handles a lot of our bonding, probably one of our attorneys out of the PA's office, maybe one or two other county staff, perhaps Ali and a few others. Is there any on the BIA or DEEB that would like to join in on that? And I will make quick work on this, try to see if we can get a meeting set up in the next week or two at the very most, and start to get to work on it.
Okay. Well, I can volunteer to help on that subcommittee. Anybody else?
I will. John Gerard.
Okay, John.
Okay.
Right, that's great. Yeah, I'll go with that. And thank you. It's great to have reps both out of BIA and DEEB,
and I'll pull together a meeting and we'll start to work on it. I think we'll have something in place. I know BIA meets every 2 weeks. We meet monthly. I think we've got a good shot at having some pretty solid answers within your next meetings.
Sounds great. Thank you.
One point, Greg, that I'd like to make. This is John again. Maybe you can reach out to other jurisdictions and see what they're doing, because everyone's in the same boat.
Yep. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks.
All right. And back to our regular agenda then. Greg, you want to go through the upcoming events?
Yeah, I'll be very quick on this in the interest of time. So Shannon and Melissa's put together the contacts for the council meetings and the planning commission meetings for the coming month here of October. I do want to announce that county council recently announced that they will be continuing their virtual meetings at least through the end of the year. And then they do not meet the last 2 weeks of December. So best thing there is just to hit their web page and for their work sessions and also their consent agendas. They continue to meet 10 o'clock on the first Tuesday of the month for consent and at 6 o'clock in the evening on the third Tuesday of consent. And then following that, our planning commission, they look like they're back in session. They've got a meeting here I'm seeing on the 7th and then another one on the 21st of October. So
all right, well, first up on the agenda is a presentation around our traffic improvement programs. Who's got that?
Do you have the presentation, Greg, or his staff? I know we submitted that to you.
Shannon should have it. If you need her to pull it up, I think she can try to pull that up.
That would be appreciated. Oh, thank you so much. So my name is Susan Wilson. I'm the Capital Programs Manager. I'm here with my team, Chris Carl. He's our Capital Programs Engineer, and John McSherry, who is our Capital Programs Senior Specialist level. And then also, I want to mention that we have our county engineer, Rob Klug, here with us. We're getting ready to update our transportation improvement program. So we're here to talk about some of the updates as informational only to the advisory board. So thank you for allowing us to present to you tonight. Next slide, please. So we're going to talk about some of the guiding principles set by our county council, the legalities of the transportation improvement program, and how a transportation project gets onto the program from the 20-year capital facilities plan, the evaluation system. We're also going to talk about a couple of our projects through maps and through a construction schedule, and then some project highlights, and then the steps and the schedule that we go through each year. Next, please. So some of the guiding principles that our council has set is we pay our debt service first. We currently do have a couple of Public Works Trust Fund loans. They're low interest loans that have supported projects such as the Salmon Creek Interchange project, and I think a couple segments on 119th Street corridor improvements west to east. In addition, our second principle is safety. We need to address safety on all of our corridors, especially where there are a lot of collisions and crashes that occur. And then we preserve our existing assets. So you'll see a lot of road preservation through hot mix overlay, through preserving some of our sidewalks and our bridges, and then also some of our ADA ramps and traffic signal systems. And then our capital projects, that's our large capital reconstruction projects. So 179th Street area is our largest project in the transportation improvement program. Followed by 99th Street that is currently under advertisement to seek a contractor. And then also 152nd is coming up for construction in the next couple years. Legal requirements. The Transportation Improvement Program is a state mandated document. All of our capital projects must be in the annual construction program, which is our first year of our Transportation Improvement Program, and then in our six-year Transportation Improvement Program. The county engineer, we must, is required to develop and apply a priority array. Basically, we have to have prioritized projects based upon industry standards and consistent with our council's codes. In addition, our Transportation Improvement Program is adopted before the budget's adopted. That is a state requirement. And all of our projects in our Transportation Improvement Program, they are on the 20-year capital facilities plan. And we'll talk a little more about that in a few minutes. Next slide, please. So how does a project get on to the Transportation Improvement Program? It really starts with the County Council's capital facilities plan through the comprehensive plan. So once the County Council adopts a comprehensive plan, they have a component of a 20-year capital facilities plan, which identifies a set of projects that have capacity needs that we need to address. We take all of those capital facilities projects, we evaluate them and rank them, and then we put them into the six-year Transportation Improvement Program, and we leverage funding through grants and county road fund, which is property tax, fuel tax, and then also state federal funds, traffic impact fees, and then we also have partnerships such as the not with only with developers, but also with the Washington State Department of Transportation and the small cities within Clark County. And then once we determine what we're going to build, we put it into the annual construction program. Again, the annual construction program is the first year of the Transportation Improvement Program. And then we assign a county road project number to those projects. Next slide. I'm going to go ahead and give this one to Chris Carl. He is the person who evaluates our transportation improvement projects.
Thank you, Susan. Chris Carl here, capital program engineer for Clark County under Susan Wilson. Susan mentioned the capital facilities plan and how we rank and evaluate our projects off of that capital facilities plan. On that CFP, if you will, are our larger capital projects as well as our ongoing programs, which we which I'll talk to in a little bit. But for our ranking system, it's mainly here as you see it on the screen is for our larger capital projects. Some that apply to all projects, safety, for example, collisions, whether it be injuries and fatalities, sadly, higher ranked projects, physical road features and geometry, some economic development points for things like access to highways, jobs creations, and this and the like, as well as mobility, and how that ties into both of our county outlets, route connectivities, and multimodal connecting bike and pedestrian to transit, for example, as well as some smaller factors for environmental, public and outside agency support and leveraging of funding. The more funding we have for a project, the higher it would score. But again, it even if a project didn't have outside funding, it would still be ranked within the confines of this ranking system. This is something that we also share through public meetups, whether it be neighborhood associations, DEEB, Planning Commission, and the like for suggestions of how we can improve and update the scoring through the years. Next slide, please. And as we bring in these projects and evaluate them and rank them, they go into our Transportation Improvement Program. What you see here is the lower section of our county, and I have a slide that'll show the northern section in a second. But if you look at the legend on the right, both the blue numbered projects, those are the active ranking, if you will, projects based off of this capital facilities plan and our evaluation system. And as the projects mature, and have a certain percentage, I think it's 30% of the overall budget, they become obligated. And those are our red lettered projects. They are no longer ranked, but they were previously ranked to have gotten into that position. The green projects are ongoing programs, which are, again, are off of our capital facilities plan. They're just under specific programs, annual programs of preservation are not on this map, but they're also on the capital facilities plan. So one of the bigger sections of development in the coming years is going to be all along Northeast 179th Street. If you see that big conglomerate of red and blue right there at the intersection of I-5 and Northeast 179th Street. And next slide, please. And this is just a continuation of the northern section of our county. Next slide. And I'll turn it over to John McSherry.
Greetings, my name is John McSherry. I'm a capital project specialist, public works. And this slide right here, where it talks about our proposed construction schedule for the 2021 through 2027. On the left, we've got the gray projects, which are our ongoing projects. These are the capital development projects, the larger projects. Then in the center, the yellow projects represent projects that are fully funded, going to start next year. And these are the pipeline projects coming down the pipe that are all obligated, and we're getting ready to go. And then on the far right, you have the white projects, which are further down the pipeline, 2026 to 2027. Again, these are the capital, the larger capital projects. Below, you'll see our ongoing programs, which have their own budget, and these numbers that are listed on here are for the six-year budget. You've got ongoing programs like road preservation at $39 million and $26 million for sidewalks and ADA, and $23 million for transportation safety projects. And so these are smaller projects, but there are many, many of them that are spread across the county and across the timeline. So next slide, please. So this, we're going to talk about two projects here. And I think, Chris, you were going to talk about this one since this was your project. You're on mute.
Sorry. Yep. So this is our 10th Avenue Corridor project. If you see, there's three phases total of what's in current. Right now is phase three. Phase one was the southern portion off of 139th. Phase two being what we referred to as our 10th Avenue Bridge project. And then our current one is, sorry, phase three was our bridge, and phase two is our current project. And it's about a $43 million total corridor, and possibly a future extension off of phase three to the north to match up to the convention center eventually. Next slide. Here's some photos of previous work. This is the 10th Avenue Bridge project, which bridged over Whipple Creek, previously non-existing roadway. Next slide. Aerial of the bridge. I think that's a northern view. Next slide. And this is a overhead sketch of what's going on currently with our phase that I was talking about a little bit earlier, $13 million project, improving the roadway to include two travel lanes, center turn lane, bike lanes, and sidewalks, which will match to the previous projects cross sections. Adding a new signal at 149th Street and bringing up the roadway grade, which is a current big dip. And again, our standard improvements in terms of sanitary water, storm, and the like. Next slide. I'll turn this one back over to John.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. So this project is out to bid right now. This is a 99th Street project. This project rebuilds a new roadway and reconstructs the existing roadway. There is actually a gap between 94th and 105th. That's along the north edge of the landfill, the Lechner landfill that's there. So that roadway will be constructed new, and then the roadway between 105 and SR 503 will be reconstructed, and that includes sidewalks, new roadway, bike lanes, sidewalks on both sides. There are also a lot of walls that will be constructed along there, and obstructions that will be removed. There'll be three roundabouts that are constructed at 94th and 107th, and then also at 110th, 112th. So this will be a roundabout corridor between 94th and SR 503. I think I got all the good stuff in there on that one. It's a $23 million project. It's going to take 2 years to complete. We'll hopefully be starting up in the spring, and it'll go through to the winter of 2024. That's next slide. Susie, you want to take over from here?
Sure, I'll be happy to. So, really our kickoff for our transportation improvement adoption usually starts a little bit earlier. We usually start to have a work session with council in March. However, this one was just a little bit delayed due to the COVID pandemic. And so we did have a work session with council on August 18th, and that officially kicks off our transportation improvement program. We want to make sure that we are including everything that we need to include into our program. And then we go through a lot of updates with our revenues, our expenditures. We prepare a lot of documents such as our SEPA, and we do a lot of public education and involvement through open houses. We already met with the neighborhood associations. We've done some social media campaigns. We also had a TIP open house at the end of last month to get some more public education involvement. And then we are meeting with the Planning Commission tonight for a work session, and then going into a hearing in a couple weeks with them. And then we're here talking with you guys, you folks, for more information, more public outreach. And then as soon as we get all that organized, we will seek public notice to go to hearing with council. And currently we're looking at November 3rd for the hearing date. So that is our process this year. Next year we will evaluate the projects. We're going to add a few more components. And then plus we'll update all of our traffic information to make sure that nothing's changed there. Next slide, please. And thank you. Any questions, comments that you have for us? Hearing nothing, that concludes our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, up next, I guess Phil and Justin is.
Yep, and I'll defer to Justin. We met yesterday, and Justin's prepared a presentation. He'll run through some comments.
Okay.
Shannon, when you get a chance, if you wouldn't mind pulling that up.
Is
Is that the correct one?
No. Perfect.
Here you go. Yep.
So thank you all for letting me do this presentation. Today we'll be discussing the Clark County Housing Action Plan. And this is based on the Clark County Housing Options Study and the governing legislation behind that. And we'll go through all of that. This was developed by myself as well as Phil Weiss with Ginn Group. And at one point in the presentation, I may defer to Phil for his expertise on land use. Next slide, please. Governing legislation, House Bill 1923 gave a $100,000 grant from the Washington State Department of Commerce to cities and counties to do a housing option study and then draft a plan to increase affordable and middle housing opportunities. A quick synopsis there. Currently, we're in the stage of developing our housing action plan. And this presentation is kind of in response to the draft, the potential strategies draft formed by the Project Advisory Group. Again, I won't go into full detail. I think it's really important that we have the framework and metric of what affordability is. I've outlined it here. You know, you are cost burdened if your monthly income exceeds, 30% of your month, or your rent exceeds 30% of your monthly income, and then 60% for rental units and owner-occupied housing of 80% based on the median family income adjusted for family size for the county where the household is located, as reported by Washington State United Department of Housing.
Justin, can I interrupt just a moment? Somebody's typing. If everybody could mute. It's a little distracted. Thank you.
Yeah. So again, it's important to keep this kind of in the forefront of our minds as we go through this public and then different public entities, planning commission, things of that nature, and what affordability really is and the difference between subsidized housing and affordability. And what we here at BIA have been saying is housing attainability, specifically for a home ownership model. Next slide, please. So I think Phil and I really wanted to take this in two separate pieces. One piece was, what are the strategies we can implement right now that would affect both projects in the pipeline currently and projects in the next year or two? So kind of splitting that up between what strategies can be implemented now or very soon, and then what strategies can be implemented long term. So a couple of those reduce minimum lot sizes for townhomes. Again, here, A1.2 is in the potential draft potential strategies. Talking with members, a minimum lot size for townhomes of 1750 or 1800 would work for the industry. Introduce minimum lot sizes for triplexes, or reduce actually, and less than current lot area per dwelling unit. The industry agrees with this increase, allowing housing types in lower medium density zones. I also wanted to add just some things that didn't get into the presentation. Allow construction of triplexes and four quadplexes where it's allowed in the underlying base zone. And upon issuance of a land use decision, the builder should and developer should be able to pull a building permit and start construction. So really streamlining that process to a type one review for triplexes and quadplexes, and really increasing that density. And not forgetting that not only do we have affordability crisis, but an underproduction of housing across the board. Yes.
Hey, real quick, before we go off of that topic, if you don't mind, I don't know if you want to wait, but on that particular one, changing that process to a type one where you just pull a building permit would have a huge impact, because if you have to go through the land use process, even for a type two application, to put in a triplex or even a quadplex, it's not cost effective. The cost of going through a type two land use process is probably, it starts at about $60,000, and most of the time it ends up much higher than that, probably closer to 100. So the cost of just doing a building permit, like if you were just going to put a single home on or even a duplex, those right now are allowed in on a type one process, basically just through the building permit process. Allowing those, all the other multiplexes in the type one process, would have a huge benefit. So if you want to kind of add that to your recommendation or make note of it.
Yeah, of course. And a great point there. And again, if allowed in the underlying base zone, there's kind of no reason why we shouldn't be streamlining that process. And then again, to recap, increase maximum lot coverage to 70% across the board, except where it's already higher in the zoning code. Again, the more lot we can use, bigger the space we can build, the more housing we can build as well. It's just cost effective and makes sense. Reduce minimum lot width to 20 feet for detached housing, and for attached housing, go down to 14 feet. Again, that lot width. And there has been in a couple jurisdictions, their housing action plans, they've taken somewhat of the opportunity to institute design standards on lots that aren't as wide. And these can kind of target driveway widths, front facades, what percentage of a garage is taking up a front facade, and then kind of the entryway. You know, some jurisdictions want that front door, that neighborhood feel, rather than a side door. And so kind of balancing what the market wants and what's livable with kind of that neighborhood community feel and those aesthetics. And then one last thing, modify the PUD ordinance, reduce applicable lot sizes to 2.5 acres, reduce open space from 12% to 10%. Again, small changes that can make a huge difference. Next slide, please. So multiple strategies call for requiring minimum density or even removing density limits. We believe this carrot and stick approach would have unintended consequences. They do kind of do the same thing, but again, carrot and the stick. And at this point, I would like to hand it off to Phil for this slide to kind of explain how can we calculate density based on gross site area, and kind of if it matches the underlying zone and the density, that's how we should kind of be calculating density. So Phil, if you're still on the line, love to hear from you.
Yeah, I won't take long. I mean, the concept here is pretty simple. If we use gross site area to calculate maximum density on a project, then all product types are treated equally. If you take, and the example is that if you take the same piece of land and develop it as a site plan where you have a private driveway, your maximum density is calculated using the entire area, because the private aisleway to the parking lot isn't deducted from your max density. If you take the exact same piece of land and plat it and put a public roadway through it, your max density goes down because the public roadway is deducted. And my position is that if I can otherwise meet all of the lot requirement standards, if I can meet minimum lot size, minimum lot dimensions, max lot coverage, and setbacks and everything else, why should the mere fact that we're subdividing rather than doing a site plan have any impact on the total site potential density? Thanks, Justin.
Of course, yeah. And just kind of piggybacking off of that, you know, with plats, at the BIA here, we really want to foster home ownership. And again, home ownership is the best way to really gain generational wealth across all demographics. So something to keep in mind as well. Next slide, please. Again, kind of home ownership and middle housing. That's one of the goals of the governing legislation here, is to create middle housing options that can create ownership opportunities. And again, kind of to the points Phil was making, it seems the industry is penalized for plats, site plan versus subdivision again. And one of the potential strategies in the draft was small lot subdivisions. We think that's a great idea as an industry, and we would love to kind of work as partners on that. I think it's a product type that could see a lot of growth here in the future. And then again, expand residential opportunities in commercial zones through a type 3 zoning change. There was mention of, you know, horizontal residential kind of mixed use, and kind of the difference between those mixed use product types, and kind of making it easier for redevelopment for commercial. Next slide, please. Concerns on limiting product type. The two strategies we have right here, A5.6 and A5.7, limiting single-family detached uses in medium-density zones, either by prohibiting them or limiting them to a portion of the PUD development. And then the same kind of goes for townhomes here. I'll let you read it, but for high-density zones. If we're achieving the same density, and it's just an issue of product type, that doesn't make any sense. And really, we need to be looking at maximum density based on gross site area and not really dictating what product types are being put there. So that's a concern we have as an industry. The GMA calls for a variety of housing types. These product types generally offer ownership opportunities, and as I stated, best way to gain generational wealth. And an example of something we could add to the PUD ordinance and some others that other jurisdictions have is duplexes on corner lots and having, you know, a bonus density, an incentive really for that. Next slide, please. Off-street parking requirements. In general, we are in favor of lessening off-street parking requirements, but it's important to keep in mind what the market wants. So adjust strategy B1.3, address driveway spacing and access requirements for townhomes. We need to be careful not to take the housing action plan as an excuse to institute additional design standards. Again, as I mentioned, with the driveways, front entrances, front facades. So keeping in mind balancing off-street parking with what works for the market. And then B1.6, revising minimum parking for multifamily to 1.5. We actually think this could be reduced to 1.2. So something there as well. Next slide, please. Simplifying design standards. I think Deep has heard this before about revising the cottage housing code. This is something that could be achieved right now, a lessening of the open space requirement coupled with a square foot exemption for possibly one to two attached garage to the cottage unit. Again, the intent of the code for cottage housing is a smaller unit, but multiple jurisdictions throughout Washington do have an exemption for at least one, like a single attached garage to the cottage house. And also speaking with some of our members, you can actually get more units on a site when there is that single attached garage on the unit rather than a communal parking situation, which is typical of cottage housing developments right now. Next slide, please. Okay, so here we have kind of more of the long-term solutions, upzoning. Again, probably the most transparent way to do this. There's concerns about residential infill development and the backlash from the community that would come with that. A lot of these strategies are kind of addressing that, and so that's something to kind of keep in mind when we go into these discussions. Revised condominium liability laws. Current projects are targeting to the higher price points and the higher end of the market just because of the possibility of kind of liability issues and things like that. So it's important that on a state level, we revise those laws and have a more viable solution so we can create more affordable condominiums that create, again, a home ownership opportunity for people. Commercial redevelopment, the city of Vancouver thinks that that will be something that's definitely going to be on the table here in the next 10 to 20 years, as well as the Highway 99 sub-area plan. So I think that will be important as well, and really making it easy and streamline those processes. Process improvements, electronic plan review for permitting in Clark County, SEPA and stormwater, SEPA exemptions for infill, things like that. And I'd love to hear maybe some perspective on regional stormwater facilities. Is that something that the industry would be beneficial to the industry? And then ample communication to citizens on what middle housing is and what affordability is versus a subsidized housing model. And again, those middle housing options in hopes of creating more home ownership opportunities. Next slide, please. Long-term concerns. The Growth Management Act, the goal of the Growth Management Act is to prevent urban sprawl. SEPA review should be less strict within the UGA. Again, we shouldn't be having as strict environmental review for an urban site rather than a rural site, given kind of the disruptions that happen with it. We do want growth within the urban center. and all the good that comes with that. Open the PUD ordinance, as I mentioned earlier, those open space requirements, and then applicable lot size down to 2.5 acres. Strategy G1, notice of intent to sell. We have to balance private property rights with issues of affordable housing, displacement. We really have to balance that, but we do need to protect people's private property rights and in that regard. And then B6.2, revisit private road standard requiring sidewalks on only one side of the road to determine if these meet pedestrian needs while providing site design flexibility. Again, this could make or break a project based on how many units you could get onto the site. It really could, and kind of antithetical to density and affordability. Now, if we're talking about a total public road, that's a different conversation. We do want walkability, we do want mobility options, but kind of antithetical to density and affordability in that regard. Next slide, please. And I will kind of open it up to the board here for questions and discussions.
If I could, I'd like to just make one, just reiterate what Justin said at the beginning of the presentation. Housing affordability, housing supply, it's an immediate, complex, charged issue. As Justin and I reviewed the housing action plan strategies, you know, there's a bunch of great strategies in there. Many of them, upzoning, parking ratios. Many of these strategies are controversial and will likely take time to process. I think we'd really like to see some of the easier strategies, maybe less controversial strategies that could result in some immediate benefit, and move ahead and not be weighted down by what are, you know, legitimate issues that will take quite a bit of public process to get through.
This is Don Russo. Could you give us some kind of definition of what the middle, I forget the term that it was used, middle level housing? What are we exactly, are we talking about?
So I can try to answer that, Don. Eco Northwest did a feasibility study kind of coupled with this housing action plan. And what they came up with was, I think the product type was a townhome. I think it was around 2,200 square feet at a price point of 320,000. They thought that that was the most viable home ownership opportunity for the most amount of people in Clark County. So.
But Don, I would say, I mean, it's a broad definition of missing middle. It spans tenure type, so it's in both rental and ownership tenure. But it's housing that's attainable for, I think, working families and regular people. And it's also providing a continuum of product types so that people can get into their first home. It can include condominiums, which is why, I mean, reform of the condo liability law is important. But yeah, just putting back in some missing rungs of sort of the housing ladder so people have an opportunity to buy that first place, gain equity, you know, buy a second place maybe as their family grows.
I would think that the median price of $320,000 today would be an obstacle for many families where both parents are working, where they have minimum wage jobs.
Justin, did the group look at trying to put some incentives in for infill, like what's in the city where you can downzone and, you know, or upzone, I guess would be the term you guys would use immediately? And I see that you guys have suggested lowering the size of a PUD down to 2.5 acres. Would, if you did something where there's an infill incentive, what about increasing the maximum size of an infill? Right now in the city, it's 2.5 acres. If you want something more like 4 acres, it'd probably be
there'd be more incentive to do infill.
Right. So I don't have a ton of context on this. There was a whole list of different strategies, one being that SEPA infill exemption. And they kind of just listed the general legislation that has come out of Washington State. So there wasn't a ton of, I guess, extra strategies for infill that I saw. And Phil, maybe you saw differently.
I think there's been a little bit of discussion on that, and I think it's worthy of discussion and should be carried forward. But that's one of those things that, again, once we talk about infill, we're talking about existing neighborhoods that could be a heavy political lift. I think it's a great strategy and we should focus on it, but it's because of potential implications and controversy. To me, it's more one of those longer term policy changes. Maybe not.
Okay. Mike?
Yeah, good presentation. A lot of interesting ideas. I've read through this and perused it a couple times since, and it looks like there are some low-hanging fruit that could be implemented. Just a couple of comments with regards to that. We need to have, you know, our staff on board, because this would mean code changes, which goes through PC and the council. And right now, staffing levels are not such that they're even entertaining any code revisions right now. So hopefully this doesn't, you know, go the way of the dodo by the mere fact that staff doesn't have the capability to bring it forward, let alone get it implemented. So the second comment that I had was, you mentioned a $320,000 price range for the vast majority of people in Clark County, I believe. That would mean, based on a 4-to-5-to-1 ratio, lot cost to unit cost, that means that your finished lots would need to be between $64,000 and $80,000 a lot. Is that even attainable these days?
It is not.
No.
And that feasibility study, I believe, was done in 2019. So some older information based on.
Yeah. So even if lots, and we know that they're north of 100,000 now, you can't build anything for under $400,000 or $500,000 if your lot costs and make any money. And so I'm kind of curious as to how this whole part of this works in with the economic part of it, land cost, development costs, and everything else, and whether or not we implement all of these neat ideas, but nothing will come of it because nobody can afford to do it, and we'll just end up with a bunch of smaller houses, smaller lots that are still out of the price range of most people in Clark County.
Land supply is an issue, and I think particularly in the medium density ranges. And it's not just land supply as a gross matter, it's available land supply. And I know everyone who's worked on the vacant buildable lands model and comprehensive planning in the past knows that, but it's a big deal. It's hard to find land in sort of that missing middle housing bracket to build on.
And even if we had that available land, just let's say for some reason they decide to add 100 or 200 more acres to the UGB, does that then, I don't know as if that necessarily equates to land costs coming down. It's very hard to bring the cost of something down once it's at a certain level. And if it does start coming down, it's certainly not to the level that we would need it in order to make it affordable.
Yeah, Mike, there's another piece to that too, though, and that is the total supply. And even if the product they're building today isn't necessarily always affordable for a certain bracket, what it does is it makes the existing, it allows people to move up to make it as affordable as it can be. It allows people to move out of their existing homes, which may be older homes, into a newer home, and then it opens that up. It's kind of like the analogy of, you know, you can't build an affordable new car, but people buy used cars because that's what they can afford. So anytime you can increase the supply, it helps the general cost in the market. And what we've seen today is that there's so few new homes being able to be built, and that price point's so high that the availability is so low that it drives up even all the existing ones and makes them unaffordable as well. So we definitely have a supply issue. And this is a piece. This is one piece of it. It's not the whole solution. This is trying to come up with those options, and then also the land supply and regulation cost and construction material cost. They all make an impact, and this is one piece of a big problem.
Right.
Eric, that freezes up. I mean, it's a great example, and I think it's important to recognize that there's a relationship between the rental market and the for sale market. And, you know, when you don't have enough supply, particularly in the entry level product, you freeze up the rental market, and you know, because people can't make the jump from rental to ownership tenure. And yeah, so it's a housing market. It all works together.
Like I said, Phil, that missing middle, it's very hard to find middle density type of land to be able to put forth anything. And so much of the that middle density has been eaten up by apartment development in the last 8-10 years. So it's very difficult for that ownership piece to have a step in the rung.
All right, any other questions, comments? Well, thank you, gentlemen, for the information and all the work that you've done getting to this point. So
thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Up next on the agenda, looks like electric vehicle requirements. There was some discussion last month that I was missing on, and sounds like there's a memo that's been written to describe where we're at with stuff. I believe that memo was put out by Ravi.
So good afternoon. I sent that memo with 4 attachments. So if Shannon can bring it up, then I'll go through what the requirements are from Clark County point of view. Now, first of all, I would like to say that what I'm going to say here is right now I didn't have a chance to get that validated by the building official because he is out on vacation, but he is going to be back. So if he disagrees with any of these things, then we may have a little change in the position. But so far, what I have presented in the memo is consistent with what we have been doing in the past and has been consistent with my discussions with him. So I wanted to throw that disclaimer out up front, so that we know that this is not exactly the final thing, is subject to change. We can always do that, So before I get into this, I would like to just, bring the board up to date on the building code. And I am sure quite a few of you know how the building code is adopted, but currently we have 2018 IBC building code adopted with Oregon amendment, with Washington amendments. Sorry, I worked in Oregon for too long, so it's still there. So with Washington amendments. Now, electrical vehicle charging stations, it's not included in the model code. So Washington State, they came up with their own amendments and they adopted in the previous edition and they carried forward to the same requirements were carried forward into the current code. But they didn't make any change. And the way it is written is a big confusion. And it's a nightmare for the building community to enforce it. So I am sure all of that has been communicated to the State Building Code Council because they have been working on it and they have made some changes and they have clarified the confusion. So in the next code, what is going to show up is what they have made the changes that is shown in my attachment number D, which is the final version. Now, but we as a jurisdiction, we cannot start enforcing what is being adopted till it gets adopted. So our position is based on what the intent is and what the code says. So the current code says that you need to provide, if you have the parking, total number of parking spots more than 20 in a affected use, which is the R1, 2, and B occupancy. If the total parking spaces is more than 20, then 5% of those spaces need to be provided with electrical vehicle charging stations.
I just want to interrupt
to your point, Mike.
I just wanted you to explain the different, that just provide a quick definition of the occupancy types.
Okay, so group B is a typical B occupancy, like an office space, or it could be a medical facility, it could be a bank, it could be any occupancy where transaction type of, not a mercantile, but like a service kind of an industry, you know?
So like a restaurant or something like that?
No, it's no, occupant load is not linked to any, you know, it could be, you could have a B occupancy with 200 people in that, you know? But it could be, so it's the nature of the occupancy, nature of the use. So if it is a office space and it's a multi-storied office space, then it's a B occupancy. But okay. But I think where you're coming to, Mike, is like a restaurant. Mm-hmm. If the occupant load is less than 50, then that's considered as a B occupancy. You know, I think that's where you're alluding to, I think, because restaurant would otherwise be classified as an assembly occupancy, A occupancy, but the court says very clearly that if your total occupant load in a restaurant is less than 50, then you classify that as a B occupancy. You
know? Less than 50.
Less than 50, yes.
And what if it's more than 50?
If it is more than 50, then it gets its own original classification, whatever that assembly is, whether it's A1, A2, or A3, you know, depending on the use, whether it's a bar, whether it's a sit-down restaurant, whether it's a big gathering place, okay. You know, so.
Good, thank you. And then the R1 and R2?
R1 and R2, R1, so the difference between the two, they are both like an apartment, lodges, motel, that kind of thing. But the difference between R1 and R2 is one of them is transient in nature, like R1. So like you have in a motel, people stay there for a day or 2 days, whereas an R2 is like an apartment building where the nature of occupancy is a little bit more stable, more longer.
Thank you. I'm not familiar with those and I appreciate it.
Absolutely, absolutely. You can ask me any questions related to building code. That's what I live and breathe every day. So basically the current code says if the total number of parking spaces in these three occupancies is 20 or more, then you need to provide 5% of those spaces to be electrical vehicle charging station needs to be provided in those. And at least one parking space in handicapped accessibility needs to be to be provided with EV stations. And then it also says that there should be a scope of increasing this capacity to 20%. So what that means is that the electrical room which is inside the building, it has to be designed for 20%. Capacity of the parking space, but the equipment inside the room needs to be only provided for 5% of the parking spaces. And the infrastructure for the additional spaces needs to be accounted for, but the charging stations need to be provided for that 5%. Now, if you read the code straight, is difficult to make that difficult to arrive at that conclusion, because the way the code is written, it says either you provide that 5% or you provide that additional capacity, which is, so I took an example that, okay, if you have 100 parking spaces, the code would require 5%, so 5 parking spaces to be provided with the EV stations, or alternately, the code would allow you to just provide 20% minus 5, which gives you 15 parking spaces that has the infrastructure provided. If you go with that interpretation of the code, you have basically not implemented the code at all, because the code is not supposed to be implemented that way. The code is you provide the minimum, then any additional is there should be a scope of it. So we had contacted State Building Code Council, and they provided us with this document. And by the way, attachment A and B are just the photocopies of the building codes. You know, A is the photocopy of the building code from the previous building code, and the B is the current code. So what was provided to us by the State Building Code Council is attachment C, which gives you the text in crossline and underline where they have amended the existing WAC. In this, and this has, by the way, this has been approved now at the state legislature, and this was approved on August 26th. So what you're seeing in attachment D is what is going to become the next code, whether it becomes part of the next model code whenever they adopt it, or whether it gets implemented sooner through emergency rule. But what they're doing is they're taking away the 20 parking space exemptions. So now, irrespective of how many parking spaces you have, you need to provide EV parking spaces and the charging stations. 5% rule has gone up to 10% now. That 20% still remains, that you know you need to provide the capacity of your infrastructure and the electrical room to accommodate 20%. So in the new code, which is coming up, basically they are becoming more restrictive, and they have made it very clear. They have taken away that language from the current code where they gave an option to provide only 5% or the additional capacity. They have taken away that R from the text, and now it's mandatory that that an applicant needs to provide minimum 10% of the parking spaces with EV stations, and then there needs to be a scope to expand that to 20%. So the additional 10% parking spaces need to be provided with the infrastructure. So that's what is coming in the pipeline. So our position has been, till that comes, we will stick with the percentage rule with the current one, which is 5%. We will still allow that 20 parking space exemption, but we will stick to that principle of requiring EV stations on the first 5% of the parking spaces. That's our position right now, and is based on, even though it's not very clear in the building code, but it's based on the input received from State Building Code Council and everybody else. That's my presentation in a very nutshell, and I would be willing to take any questions or answer any questions anyone may have. So.
Yeah, I just have some comments. I've been discussing this with several clients of mine that do multifamily housing and retail and restaurant projects, and as well as speaking with their general contractors. Has there been, so here's the thing about this, that this charging station, the electrical vehicles are still in their infancy. There's one, maybe two manufacturers out there that make them right now, three, whatever it is. They're still not necessarily in the mainstream, although they're certainly moving up in the mainstream. I think that there's, I don't think that there's a whole lot of consistency, and maybe there is, but I don't know much about electrical vehicles, but consistency as far as charging ports, adapters, different manufacturers have different requirements. For instance, Tesla can only go to a Tesla charging station. And then the supply aspect of this too, do we know that there are enough electrical vehicle charging stations out there in order to supply what the state is mentioning and that the county is interpreting as the requirement for these projects? Has there been any consideration of that? And I really, I know you can't answer that from a state level, but from a local level, if there aren't any around, will the county still provide occupancy certificates if there's a supply issue? It's very similar to this transformer thing that we were talking about earlier today. Yeah, great. Hey, I've got my building up. I'm ready. I've got tenants ready to move in. And the last thing I need are these charging stations, and I can't find them. They're either on a ship somewhere floating out in the middle of the ocean, or they're all sold out everywhere. Or, hey, what kind do you want? Well, we don't know. Will the county make a provision or an allowance or something to allow these projects to move forward should there be a supply issue associated with procurement of the charging stations?
I would say yes, because, but again, that would be speaking on behalf of the building official. But based on past experiences and the way we deal with the projects, providing a electrical vehicle charging station space is not a life safety issue, you know. So it normally issuance of a certificate of occupancy is hinged upon meeting all the requirements for a safe occupation of the building by the occupants. So if you don't have the parking spaces for a while, I don't think that's going to limit their ability to work inside the building, you know. So I think we, on a case-by-case basis, we have dealt with similar kind of issues. Like some people, they don't have the landscaping done, you know, and they want to occupy the building. We allow that because landscaping has no direct relationship with the life safety issues of the building. So yeah, I think we have that flexibility in our department, and we look at those on a case-by-case basis. I don't think we can generalize it in black and white on a paper that, okay, we would do it, because we don't know what the specific situation might be, you know. But on a case-by-case basis, we deal with those issues. Okay.
Good, that's encouraging.
I had a couple of questions, Ravi.
Sure.
On the jump to 10%, any idea when the state is going to have that in place for that the code change?
So right now, if you look at the timelines, state is currently looking at 2021 IBC, and they had invited code changes, and they have gone through review of those code changes. So as early as September 30th was their TAG and the State Building Code Council meeting, which met, and I think they agreed on some of those code changes. So they are still working on it. I think their goal is by January of 2022, they intend to make a recommendation to the State Building Code Council. Then they will draft some rules which will take it to the legislature for adoption. And I think that their ultimate goal is to make the code effective, I think, end of 2022. I think that's what it is. But they keep on changing the dates, as just like they did this time, you know. So, but I think that's the tentative dates right now. They're working on it. So
when that change comes through, will there be a requirement to for all of the current development to add the additional EV stations?
Yes. So the way the code works is the effective date of the code becomes that becomes the charging, you know, the driving force. So if you submit the plans, so if the plans are submitted for permit before that date, then the old code applies, and then it is submitted. But like we have seen, like in Oregon, I used to see that very often, that they used to give a grace period of 30 days or 90 days, you know, so that designers, they can adjust their design to the current code requirements. And I guess if that's a recommendation from the DEEB or other stakeholders, I'm sure we could look into that and come up with a policy. That's definitely within the jurisdictional authority of the building official. He can do that. So,
okay. Then I had the other question I had was around the notation here is on the percentage of parking spaces. Is it on the percentage of actual parking spaces or required parking spaces? Because on all my developments, you know, minimum is 1.5, and I strive to get 2 or a little over 2 per apartment.
So the code language says where parking is provided. So that's where it's up to, you know, it becomes a little interpretation issue, but we don't get into the planning issue that how much parking was required. We look at how much is provided, you know, because that's how we establish how many accessible spaces are needed. So that would be our baseline. We'll look at how much is provided and then calculate the percentage based off of that.
So I get penalized for being a good guy.
Sometimes, yes.
Yep. Okay.
Mike?
Yeah, just one last question. Do you think that they're going to add any other occupancies to this or leave it at the B, R1, and R2 occupancies? Have you heard any scuttlebutt?
Not yet, nothing, because right now they are so much focused only on this thing, you know? And if that happens, it's going to be a very long drawn process because it has to go through several various stages, you know? So I think it's going to remain focused on these right now, so.
Robbie, I appreciate you bringing this to our attention and giving us a good explanation of it. I think this provides a little more clarity to what we need to advise our clients of, and they need to consider when they do their pro formas and their budgets and everything else. I still think that there's going to be some issues associated with it, so just be prepared for that, because like I said, availability and compatibility and everything. I mean, thank goodness they didn't have us all put, you know, gas stations in these facilities so that the cars that run on gas can just fill up right there. And I do know of I have clients that are going to be putting them in voluntarily and probably more than what is minimally required, but there are others that, you know, this is a big surprise. It's still in its infancy, and any flexibility that the building department can provide moving forward is going to be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? All right. Thanks, Ravi.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That was awesome.
All right. Next up on our item agenda is the Columbia River Scenic Gorge updates. I believe that's
bring that one up. Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Deep board members. My name is Mike Salas, and I've never actually been in front of your board, and so welcome.
or welcome me, I guess. I've been with the county for almost 2 years now, but just in the office the first 3 months, and then out of the office ever since. So this is becoming my new norm, is having this type of a meeting. So I just want to let you know, we're just here to give a presentation on the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Code Amendments, and kind of bring you up to date to where we're at and where we're headed over the next few months. We have some staff here that are able to answer some of the questions. We have staff from community planning, from community development, and I don't think we have anyone here from the Gorge Commission at this point. But we also have ways to for you guys to make comments on our website as well. So let's go ahead and get started. Next slide. So the agenda, we're just going to go through the background and the Gorge Ordinance updates from last year till now. Changes in code 240, and additional changes in 4510, and then some of the questions near the end, and then sort of tell you the next steps as well. Next slide. So first, here's our background. The Columbia River Gorge Commission was established in 1987 by the state of Oregon and Washington. The commission mission is to establish, implement, and enforce policies and programs that protect the National Scenic Area. In 1991, the Gorge Commission and the Forest Service adopted a management plan which helps keep consistent standards and regulations within the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area and the Clark County Code 4240. Next. Here's a map that shows the area of the entire Gorge Scenic Area, and near the west side of it, which is closest to 205, is our section, obviously. And it's roughly around just under 8,000 acres in size. Next slide. This is the size that we're talking about. This includes the entire area that's within the scenic area that's part of Clark County. Next slide. And this, I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the Gorge Ordinance itself. In October 13, 2020, the Gorge Commission adopted revisions to the management plan as part of a three-year update. The Gorge Commission focused on updates to increase protections in the scenic and natural resource chapters, as well as economic development, land use, urban area boundary revisions, and recreation chapters. The county adoption of revisions is mandatory under the National Scenic Area Act of 1986, which protects the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area, along with RCW 4397015, the Columbia River Gorge Compact. Variations are allowed if it provides greater protection with gorge resources. Next slide. The county has 270 days to adopt these revisions, and that started in March of this year and ends on December 11th of this year. Ordinance amendments go into effect after the Gorge Commission and the Secretary of Agriculture and Forest Service concur, and the amendments are consistent with the management plan. Next slide. These aren't all of them, but here's some of the related code changes that we do have and that are going to be changed within 4240. Update wetland protection policies to require a no loss of wetland functions rather than the previous standard of no net loss. Allow cideries to follow the same guidelines as established for wineries. Allow fruit and produce stands to sell a broader range of agricultural products and incidental materials. Include new guidelines and some land use designations for owner-occupied overnight accommodations limited to 90 room nights per year. Exempts buildings that are 1500 square feet or less from the compatibility guidelines for scenic resource protection. Next slide. Update guidelines for recreational developments, including new recreation settings, descriptions of each recreational intensity class, and then lastly, an update of agricultural income test for new dwellings on agricultural land requiring applicants to produce 80,000 in gross agricultural income in 2020 dollars in debt indexed annually to inflation before the dwelling can be permitted. Next slide. Additional changes that are outside of 4240 would clarify the appeals for final decisions are heard by the commission, and throughout 4240 replace the word mail with the word sent to be consistent with 4510 and its procedures. Next slide. This is where we're doing for the public participation. We created a project webpage, and you can see a longer list of the changes that we'll have in a table that Susan Ellinger put together for us. And it'll show a much larger length of what those changes are on our webpage. And that'll be at the end as well. So we put that together. We had a virtual public meeting last night to engage the public with questions and comments. We have SEPA distribution as well for comments. And then we have our meeting here that allows you to ask questions and provide comments as well. And then we have a work session with the Planning Commission here in an hour and a public hearing on the 21st coming up with the Planning Commission, followed by a second work session with the County Council. We've had one already on the 18th of August. And then lastly would be a public hearing after that. Next slide. Here it is, gives you a better sense of the timeline that we're looking at. Right now we're on October 7th, but we did have one on the 18th as far as a work session with the council. We did have the public meeting last night on the 5th. This is one of two meetings that are presentations we're giving today, and followed by on the 21st with the Planning Commission having their public hearing. And then our second work session with the County Council on November 10th, followed by the public hearing with the County Council on December 6th. After that, the county submits the approved ordinance to the Gorge Commission, and then the Gorge Commission approves and submits it to the Secretary of Agriculture for concurrence, and the Secretary of Agricultural concurrence with special management area portions are done at the end. Next slide. So I just want to thank you guys for listening to me, and if you have any questions or comments, that'd be great. Also, if there's questions or comments that you need more information on, then you can also put the link to the webpage in there. And if you have any questions, feel free.
So this is Jamie. First of all, I've got massive concerns about this, especially the changes to the procedures. And I'm sure that this isn't widely broadcast, but I've sued the Gorge Commission. We have our case pending in front of the Clark County Superior Court for challenging the adoption of the management plan on a variety of grounds, including some of the stuff that's being proposed here. I think we'll wait to have our full exposure at the Planning Commission and the County Council there. Since the adoption of the management plan by the Gorge Commission, there was also a Ninth Circuit decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that just came down at the end of August, which I think calls into question a lot of the authority that the Gorge Commission has to force some of these changes upon Clark County. So again, my biggest concern is the changes to 510.
Okay. Well, thank you for your comment. If there's additional information you'd like to write in, we will take all those comments into consideration, obviously, and make it part of the public record. And it looks like this is also being recorded, so that'd probably be good if we had a copy, if we can get a copy of the record for this as well, and we can make that part of our public record.
It'll be forthcoming.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, not.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Quiet group today.
You're welcome.
And welcome to Deeb.
Thank you.
Yes. Jamie, this is Oliver. You're very familiar with the process. So the Planning Commission hearing is the 21st. We will welcome written comments to the PC, and that will be provided to them. As you are aware, I cannot comment on any pending lawsuit. I'm not an attorney, you know that. So what we are trying to do is we got a copy of the management plan that was transmitted to Clark County from the Gorge staff. The changes that we are making now, I have directed staff, and I think legal agreed that it's going to be limited to what is in the management plan. We are not proposing anything outside of that because that's the law. So that is all I can say. There are some recommendations, and Mike mentioned this yesterday. We had an open house last night. There were some comments from friends. There's some comment from the Gorge staff. We are looking at that, but I have utmost support that I'm not going to be proposing anything in our code that is outside of what the management plan that was transmitted to Clark County. So we will have an opportunity to review both plans and make sure that what we are proposing is consistent with the management plan. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and I think my main concern, Oliver, is, you know, I think just because the Friends of the Gorge tells you something, that isn't necessarily the truth, and you still are required to follow Washington state law. And as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just, told the Gorge Commission, that this is a creature of state statute. It is not a federal entity. There's nothing that trumps state laws in regards to state processes here. So I'm cautioning the county very strongly on those changes to 510, and you know, you will be seeing our response prior to Planning Commission.
Thank you, I appreciate that, and thank you so much. We look forward to that, and I think what we'll do is look at again what is in the Gorge and try to see if there's any changes we can make to be consistent with that when it comes to our appeal. And that's really the question, who does that appeal go to? I think that's the only change we're trying to make in 510. We'll take your comment and run with it and see what the Planning Commission and Council decide. So thank you. My sincere thank you to the DEBA board for allowing us to share this with you. Majority of you don't even have developments in the Gorge. It's a very small area, but we thought we'll come to you to share the information with you. There's so much in our project webpage. It's over 200 pages in terms of the document. Don't want to bore you with that. There's going to be a table that will be much, much easier to follow in terms of what changes we are making, where you can find that. And you can also look up the gorge plan itself to make sure that is they are both consistent. So thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Oliver.
All right, thank you. Any other comments? Any other issues anybody wants to bring forth?
I think we've discussed enough for today.
Jeff Riston did join 45 minutes late, but I apologize. But I did join. So.
Whatever.
Thanks. I know, whatever. I know, for what it's worth. Didn't hear from us, but yeah, I'm here. And Mike, you and I still have to talk. I think we are on next month.
Yeah, I think we are too. We got to find some time to get together on this.
That sounds good. I'd rather do that, actually. That sounds good. Major Zoom or person. So, sounds good.
Hey, though, I said, Jeff, I will vouch for you. You have been working hard on other things. So,
yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jamie.
You're welcome. Yeah. All right, well then, I guess we're adjourned and we will be back here on November 4th, Lord willing.
Heading into the holidays.
Yeah. All right, see y'all.
Thanks.
Just thought I would throw that out for everyone.
Have a good night.
All right, guys.
Thank you. See you guys later.
Yeah.